Let's introduce our panel who are looking at this morning's newspapers, which, as I said, were sent to print before the Delaney story broke last night. Tanya Ward is CEO of the Children's Rights Alliance. Good morning to you, Tanya.
Good morning.
Larry Donnelly is a law lecturer at NUI Galway and a Boston attorney. Good morning to you, Larry.
Good morning.
And Hugh O'Connell is political correspondent at Independent Newspapers. Good morning to you, Hugh.
Good morning, Gavin.
Front pages of the papers. We'll start with the Sunday Times. Godfather ran Lunny kidnap, claims priest. A parish priest in Ballyconnell said last night that a mafia-style group with its own godfather was behind the recent attack on Kevin Lunny, the Quin Industrial Holdings director who was abducted and tortured by masked men nearly 2 weeks ago. Speaking at an evening mass in Ballyconnell, Father Oliver O'Reilly said he believed this campaign was being financed by a paymaster or paymasters who had become so consumed with hatred that they had lost their moral compass. In his homily at Mass last night, he said Lunny had been subjected to a modern form of crucifixion deployed by terrorist groups such as Islamic State. He described the attack, which he said was done by hired savage thugs, as barbaric. Also a front page story to do with Greyhound Racing, another sporting body which is currently undergoing its own travails as well. Foltre Ireland and Tourism Ireland have stopped promoting Greyhound Racing as an attraction for visitors after warnings from Minister Shane Ross that the sport could damage Ireland's reputation as a holiday destination. Ross had asked the tourism agencies to review their support for coursing and Greyhound Racing in the light of the evidence available and the morality of abuses in the industry highlighted recently by the RT Investigates programme, which of course is interesting because Shane Ross is not only the minister responsible for tourism, but he's also the minister responsible for sport. So interesting that he seems to be prioritising one side of the brief perhaps over the other. Front page of the Sunday Independent managed to squeeze in a story at the very last minute about John Delaney quitting the FAI. But the front page story, Gardaí probe if criminal tried to frame Quinn. Maeve Sheehan tells us that Gardaí are investigating if the abduction and assault of Kevin Lunny was masterminded by a criminal to set up Sean Quinn. Senior Garda sources confirmed that the development is one line of inquiry that they want to bottom out in what investigators expect to be a prolonged and complex investigation. Detectives believe that they have identified the gang who abducted Mr. Lunny, slashed him, beat him and doused him with bleach as criminals placed in Cavan and the Midlands, but not the suspected mastermind. The front page story, the main story, by the way, in the Sunday Independent is one written by Hugh O'Connell Nobet, which we'll talk about in just a few minutes' time. He's telling us that the government is warning Boris Johnson that he must now table a solution to resolve the Brexit crisis within days or risk breaking the law by not seeking an extension from the EU. In an interview with the Sunday Independent, Taoiseach Simon Coveney has ratcheted up pressure on the UK Prime Minister, saying Mr. Johnson's claim that he wants a deal will be tested this week and that a credible proposal must be put forward if he is serious about getting a deal. Coveney warned, if there is not a serious effort on the British side to put forward a proposal that's credible, then I think we're into a very difficult space. Like I said, more about that in just a few minutes' time. Sunday Business Post front page story this morning is very interesting. It is a study that their business reporter Killian Woods has done about fast track developments. He's diagnosed that there are 64 different construction schemes which have been given planning approval under the fast track development scheme. Construction is yet to start on 47 of them, which means that 10,000 what were intended as fast track homes haven't actually had the sod turned on them yet at all. But he's also found an academic paper where the authors say that they have spoken to a developer whose colleague went on a radio show and talked about the need for there to be a fast track development planning system that needs to be overhauled in 2016. That developer then alleges that Simon Coveney rang up the developer in his status as Minister for Housing at the time, and that the proposals were then adopted into the Rebuilding Ireland programme and into the law of the land, lock, stock and barrel. So basically what they're suggesting is that exactly what they wanted by means of fast track developments has been adopted immediately into Irish law by Simon Coveney at the time. He doesn't comment in the story. Also on the front page of the Sunday Business Post, Martin promises a household charge media boost to boost RTE. Fianna Fáil leader Micheál Martin has pledged to bring in a new household charge for cash-strapped RTE, and he wants revenue to collect it. Households without TVs but with access to online RTE services currently don't have to pay the €160 licence fee. RTE has called for a so-called household media charge to boost its revenues, but the government has recently announced that it will delay its introduction for up to 5 years and choosing instead to prioritise a better system of collection and evasion detection for the existing licence fee. Micheál Martin telling the Sunday Business Post that he would bring that in more sooner. And finally for now, the front page of the Irish Mail on Sunday, Taoiseach's credit card spending at Celtic Tiger level. That is treble what Enda Kenny spent, it says. This is an exclusive by Anne Sheridan, who has done a Freedom of Information request. She tells us that credit card spending by Leo Varadkar's department has reached boom time levels, hitting more than €167,000 in the 2 years since he became Taoiseach. That amounts to €83,000 a year three times the 25 grand that Enda Kenny spent on his first year in the job, and it compares unfavourably to the 198,000 spent over three of the years, 2002-04, when the Celtic Tiger Taoiseach Bertie Ahern was in office. On top of that, the Taoiseach's office does not want all of its spending to be scrutinised by the public. 87 transactions in the credit card statements from June 2017 to July this year, 2019, have been redacted, with the description of the payments and individual sums blacked out, the Irish Mail on Sunday has discovered under Freedom of Information. So that is a quick tour of what is on the front pages of today's papers. Let's stick with that final theme, actually, of general spending, because the budget, unbelievably, is only 9 days away. It seems to be one of the most low-profile budgets that we've sauntered into for a while. Hugh O'Connell, you have a story in page four of the Sunday Independent today about the Taoiseach facing something of a backlash over the idea that he broached in Los Angeles earlier this week, that contrary to what Pascal Donoghue had previously told us, that there may now be some income tax cuts after all. It's a pretty weird circumstance that we're in, where a Taoiseach would be criticised for broaching the idea of cutting taxes.
Well, I think, he's facing criticism in the context of a lot of these ministers have been in to meet Pascal Donoghue in the last couple of weeks for bilateral meetings on the budget, meetings related to their own departments and extra money that they want to spend next year. And what they're encountering, I'm told, is Pascal effectively saying there's no money, everything has to be targeted towards Brexit and contingency measures and all of this. So whatever your demands are, you're going to have to water them down further, because I really can't afford to give you any extra spending power. And yet, these same ministers that I've spoken to are seeing the Taoiseach in Los Angeles talking about the idea of bringing in some tax cuts in the budget, something which we were all of the belief was kind of off the table.
Something that we were sure that Pascal Donoghue had told us, that he had called press conference
to tell us ahead
of the budget that there wasn't going to be tax cuts.
Yeah, and so, what the Taoiseach said in Los Angeles was that there would be some kind of a minimal tax package in the budget, and that did seem to contradict what we had been told thus far. Now, Pascal Donoghue was out on Friday, and indeed I spoke to him yesterday, saying that he is ad idem with the Taoiseach on this, and that there's no dispute and there's no issue, there's no discrepancy between the two.
Of
course he would say that, and the Taoiseach the Taoiseach spokesman is saying that as well. But that doesn't mean there aren't ministers in government who are annoyed that the Taoiseach is putting tax cuts on the table, because they're going into meetings with Pascal Donoghue and being told there is no money. And any money that is available, I think that a lot of people feel in government, ministers, but also Fianna Fáil, whose support is needed to pass the budget, feel that any money that is available should be directed towards public spending measures, and that tax cuts at a time when we're facing down the barrel of a no-deal Brexit isn't a good idea.
I'm sure I remember a doorstep on the plinth in Leinster House where I asked Michael McGrath that, and he basically said that he fully accepted if it was to be a no-deal Brexit, which we now kind of accept that the budget has to be framed around doing, that there simply just wouldn't be the money for payroll tax cuts. Larry Donnelly, what do you make of this? I mean, it were ever thus that the budget would actually only really be nailed down so close to the announcement, that we're only 9 days away, and yet these things are always a little bit up in the air this late in the day. But are you surprised that there seems to be such dissonance between ministers, that having been so ad idem and having had this gospel for a month now that there wasn't going to be tax cuts, that now Leo Varadkar is still putting it out there anyway?
I guess maybe the Taoiseach, I mean, he is a politician after all, maybe he couldn't help himself in trying to, I suppose, put out a bit of good news before the budget. But it strikes me in particular, because I would agree with what Michael Brennan and Aidan Corkery are saying in the Business Post today, Brexit is speaking ruthlessly politically, Brexit is great old cover for saying we just can't do it, we can't do it this year. I think most people looking at the Brexit situation and surveying what might be down the road say, fair enough, we can't expect everything this year.
I mean, they're still increasing public spending by 2.8 billion euros, so they've still got some money to do something, but clearly a lot of it is already tied up with public pay deals and demographics and other things, so that there's very little actually up in the air to actually apply.
Yeah, I absolutely. I mean, I think the Taoiseach misspoke, and I just don't quite get it. I think it was an unforced error on his part, because, again, I think most people are ready to suck it up because they're frightened of Brexit and what that might hold in store for us.
Hugh, do we know, have any intel as to what exact payroll taxes might be on the cards? Are they talking about like a very small adjustment maybe to USC, or what are they?
Yeah, so what the Taoiseach spokesman said was that there would be a modest package including the possibility of minimal changes to income taxation. Now, what I was told by someone who's well placed on this matter and has been in some of the budget talks was that they were looking at changes to the lower entry points for the universal social charge, which would take account of the fact that the minimum wage is due to go up by 10 cents, I think, in the new year. And it's that nominally it's described as a tweaking, and it would be very minor.
Yeah,
so
that nominally has a benefit for everyone, because even if you earn multiples of the minimum wage, then that small amount is taxed at a slightly lower rate.
But it's minimal stuff by the sounds of it, and it's certainly not on the scale of the Taoiseach's pledge to raise the threshold of the for the higher rate of income tax to 50,000 euro. But that was planned over 5 years, but you would expect that they would try and roll it out over in this budget and successive and on subsequent budgets, but it's not really happening.
Yeah, well, there's also a messaging thing there. If Leo Varadkar is you know, going to in front of microphones 10 or 11 days before a budget and says there's going to be income tax cuts, and if the only cut is actually the nudging the USC cutoff point so that it would save you maybe a small number, maybe like a double figure number of euros per year.
You know, as a Fine Gael minister said to me yesterday, you know, the public accepted there weren't going to be tax cuts. There was no expectation of tax cuts. No one really knows where this has come from. A Fine Gael source told me this is... could be the Hollywood air going to.
Tanya Ward of the Children's Rights Alliance. I mean, no doubt there are plenty of different areas where you would like the government to focus its spending. What do you make of things being so much up in the air so late in the day, and this idea that in such straitened times with so many areas of the public sector crying out for investment that there still could be money for tax cuts on the table?
Yeah, I mean, I don't support tax cuts at all, but I think that the change that they are proposing to reduce the USC and the PRSI for those low income workers is really important, because we do have an issue with low pay at the moment. There are a lot of people out there who are on low pay, very insecure work. So and there is going to be an increase in the national wage rate. So I think that is really important. But I do think that there's still 700 million to play for, and that 700 million could be very significant in terms of where it's targeted. There's other coverage around, should it be, you know, there's people out there, Willie O'Dea, still calling for an increase to pensions and welfare payments overall. I really think that's in the same space as tax cuts, because when you have a much smaller envelope, and there is always a place for those kinds of increases, but this year is not the time to do that. We have to be really smarter with that 700 million. And really targeted to the very vulnerable people. You know, if you're walking into a potential recession and no deal Brexit, you have to be planning for that. So the kind of targeted initiatives they should be funding, let's say for older people, you know, the living alone allowance, that's something that St Vincent de Paul is looking for. Investing in home care packages for older people. I think a lot of people will prefer that, to be able to stay in their home, than getting this €5 on the pension. And I think for children and for families, really what they need is an increase in what they call is that in welfare payments, particularly when you have teenagers who, you know, it does cost more to feed, to clothe. We know, particularly for a lot of people living in rural Ireland, living on the breadline, trying to keep their head above water, those kind of increases could make a difference. But I also think we need to be thinking about strategically about things like childcare. Childcare has been in the media a lot this week, particularly because childcare costs have gone up by 4%. You would have seen Catherine Sapone, the Minister for Children and Youth Affairs, published that yesterday or on Friday. And I think there we need to think about National Childcare Scheme is a great achievement, I think, for this government. And it will make a big difference for a lot of families, particularly those earning less than the industrial wage, because they will get €140 a week towards the cost of childcare. But there are groups that could lose out. So if you think of a lone parent who is, let's say, have their child in after school, a lot of families are saying that you will only get 17 hours under the new scheme. And that doesn't really cover them for travelling to and from work. I know there's a proposal into Pascal to invest another 6.5 million into the scheme. So a small amount of money, really. I mean, I think of that 700 million. I think that's really critical that he does follow through on that investment. Because if you think about it, if a lot of people are out of work in the next recession, they're going to need that support to retrain. So they're the kind of investments that government needs to be thinking about. But they also need to be thinking about, you can still invest in some big ticket items as well. Because if you think about it, in the middle of the recession, they invested in free GP care for children between up to the age of 6 years. I think they need to be thinking about free school meals, making a big investment there, because children can't lose out in the next recession. They can't lose out because of a no deal Brexit. And progress has been made in lifting children out of poverty in Ireland. So we can't stop that progress. I mean, there's a lot of talk about the budget, you know, looking at protecting some industries, particularly the agri-food industry, exporting industry.
And the ones that are most vulnerable if there is to be a crash.
Exactly. Yeah. And ESRI is actually saying, no, only invest in the industries that are sustainable. So they're basically saying beef industry is under a lot of pressure. You could be making investments that aren't sustainable there. I think we also need to be thinking about safeguarding certain groups of children, young people, older people in the recession that's to come. And these targeted investments are the way to go.
Hugh, Tanya mentioned the idea of needing some sort of a big ticket thing there. It's difficult to conceive of a budget that would be issued with a general election clearly on the horizon that wouldn't have some sort of a big, bold gesture.
Well,
there's a bit of a mention of this in your sister's title. Kevin Doyle had a piece yesterday about how this was going to be a very family-oriented budget.
So there's a big idea as opposed to a big ticket item, and it's this family-focused budget.
Is that just a way of spinning the fact that there isn't a big ticket item?
Yes. But certainly I think in the budget announcement on Tuesday week, you will see an emphasis on, you know, a better deal for families, which will be, as Tanya said, Tanya mentioned, free GP care. So that's due to be rolled out to under eights. And my understanding is that there will be a kind of a roadmap towards doing it for under 12s over the next few years. So you would do it incrementally, under 8s, under 10s, under 12s.
The GPs, of course, are famously on board with all of this.
Well, yeah. So that's a challenge, but it won't prevent the government from making the announcement. And the intention is to roll it out to under 8s from next year, I think, from the middle of next year. And then free dental care for under 6s, which again, you know, I remember speaking to people in the Dental Association. I'm a Dental Association representative body. I'm not sure of the name, but they're not really on board with that. They haven't really had any consultation with that from the Minister for Health. And then doing bits and pieces around, I mean, some of the issues I think which are really a focus of the government as well is home care packages, Fair Deal. These are issues which Fianna Fáil have been raising consistently in the Dáil for the last few months. And these are issues which are no doubt central in the budget, in their budget negotiations and budget demands, and also extra childcare subsidies and bringing more higher earners, I would have thought, being able to avail of the subsidies, getting a little bit more of that universal subsidy.
I noticed that Willie O'Dea has devoted the Sunday Independent column. He is still banging the drum for a €5 weekly increase, and he says that it's unthinkable that you could have Leo Varadkar broaching the idea of tax cuts and then not having money to give to pensioners.
He's also, I think, making a point which no one has really made, but I think is a valid one nonetheless, that TDs under the public service pay deal got a €1,600 pay increase in September, €1,600 a year pay increase. So why can't we find the money to give a carer or a Dáil recipient or a pensioner an extra €195 a year, which is, if we bring in a pension increase?
Certainly
in
an arguable case. I've just been doing some sums, by the way, while you've been talking there. And if the tax cut that Leo Varadkar mentions is solely the one to make sure that those on the minimum wage don't end up having to pay a higher rate of USC, you would have to bring up the USC cutoff point by an extra €500, which would mean that for anyone who earns above the minimum wage, the sum total of the tax cuts that are the tax that you would save in the course of the year would be €12.50, which is not quite the big ticket that you might like to be hanging a budget on. So maybe Leo Varadkar has got some other ideas up his sleeve. Gavin Riley with you on the record on News Talk, joined in studio by Tanya Ward, Larry Donnelly and Hugh O'Connell. There is, as ever, mountains of stuff in the Sunday papers today around Brexit and the tumultuous week that it's been in Westminster. Boris Johnson was on the Andrew Marr show earlier on, but we're not going to bother playing you the audio simply because his general message is surrender bill, get Brexit done. In fact, even if you follow him this morning on Twitter, he's now turned get Brexit done into a hashtag, which just shows you the fervour through which he's trying to pursue the getting done of Brexit. And there's a certain amount of us that would also like to get Brexit done because we'd like to devote some parts of our newspapers or our broadcast programmes or TV news bulletins to other topics, but nonetheless we are where we are. Hugh, you have an interview in the front page of the Sunday Independent with Simon Coveney, and he's laying out something of a deadline, which I suppose is really unsurprising, because before we get you to talk about exactly what Simon Coveney told you in Brussels on Friday, Brexit is supposed to happen on October the 31st. Let's park the Hillary Benn Act. The summit by which a deal will have to be done is October the 17th, which is 2 weeks this coming Thursday. But the deal is never done at the summit. The deal is always done by the Sherpas behind the scenes and by the General Affairs Council and all of that. So really, to get a full treaty done or rewritten, as Boris Johnson wants, it will have to be done pretty quickly, which leads us to what Simon Coveney told you in the interview.
Yeah, I mean, he's saying effectively that Boris Johnson, if he wants to hashtag get Brexit done, he needs to put a deal on the table or a proposal, a credible proposal, as he terms it, next week. So I don't think there's any expectation that this will happen before the end of the Conservative Party conference on Wednesday, but certainly into Thursday, Friday, Saturday, you'd be wanting, or the EU rather, wants to see a credible plan put on the table so as that it can be assessed and they can thrash out the details of it over the following week to get it ready for that summit on the 17th and 18th of October.
All of which kind of means that if there even were to be salient details or proposals put on the table this week, that they'd have to be the workable ones, because if they aren't workable, then there's no time to go and salvage them and find something else.
No, I mean, look, the position of the Irish government has always been, you know, we'll work up to the last minute to try and get a deal, but really we are at a point now where we need to see cold, hard details and facts and a proposal that is a what the EU considers to be a workable proposal that's an alternative to the backstop that effectively does the same thing as the backstop, which is difficult because Boris Johnson has fundamentally altered Britain's approach to Brexit and what sort of deal it wants, moving it away from this idea of preserving kind of a close relationship and an open border
between
the
two. Yeah,
they
want divergence.
They actually want regulatory divergence, so that therein creates the issue. So then that raises the possibility of a few things. I mean, the Taoiseach is saying to myself in the Sunday Independent today that it would be pretty extraordinary if Boris Johnson doesn't obey the law, and the law is pretty clear about what needs to happen if there's no deal by October 19th. He must apply for an extension. He's mandated to do that by the Parliament, but
there's talk of him sending a second letter alongside it
to
say please ignore the first one.
There's lots of talk about various different things that he might do or not. I mean, one thing he is clear on is he wants to get out do or die on the 31st of October.
Hashtag get Brexit done.
So in that circumstance, we're back into the no deal territory. And the other interesting thing that the Taoiseach just said to me in our interview on Friday was to give it a little more detail about what that would look like on the 1st of November. We know about these talks that the Irish government are having with the European Commission about checks and controls that would have to be implemented to preserve the integrity of the single market. What he's saying is that not all of them would necessarily come in straight away, and that there will be a timeline to roll out some of them. So that, to me, says that, and this is just an interpretation by me, that it's not necessarily going to be immediately not immediately checks and controls on November 1st.
Which makes sense, because they need to have a lead-in time that you can't just announce that you're going to do them in the third week of October and then expect them to be implemented by Halloween. It's funny that we're talking about Brexit, but actually in substance, so little has changed this week. There's been a couple of those technical non-paper papers, but ultimately we still are where we were last week. And we were saying off-air, Tania, that this really sucks the oxygen out of so many things. For example, it's been such a low-profile run-up to the budget, but that there are so many other issues that are knocking around Leinster House and the public services card and what have you, and that they're all just being choked off because Brexit has just created this vacuum where we all have to pay attention to a subject in which nothing is being done.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, and for someone who does a lot of advocacy and lobbying with government, you see that with all the civil servants. I mean, they're all meeting weekly around preparations for a no-deal Brexit. Very hard to think about anything else, and all their plans for spending an investment that they had. I mean, they were all told, as Hugh said, that nothing's going to happen within this budget. It's going to be a very targeted budget if any investment actually takes place. But the thing is, I think things took a turn for the worse, though, this week in London. And you could see it coming anyway, because this hashtag, Let's Get Brexit Done, is nearly like a call to riot. And I think if you think about some of the headlines that you saw, I mean, Boris really did a great job to shift and change the story after having 11 members of the Supreme Court rule against him. And I think the opposition didn't play it right by going in and talking about, and obviously they are under huge pressure from the electorate, some of them, their personal safety is at risk. There's no doubt about it. But they shifted the story and they allowed Boris to do what he always does, is he plays the out of control snotty English schoolboy, which we all know, and he played that out and he did it really well, and you saw all the headlines in the Telegraph, the Express, you know, he's thumping the air, he's going to get Brexit done, and I'm going to stand up to the Supreme Court. And I think they missed a trick there, and they made a major mistake. But the other thing that's coming out through the papers and what the opposition is saying is that something is very sinister about his backers. So his backers, it seems, his hedge fund backers, seem to have betted for a no deal Brexit, including Crispin O'Day, who bet 300 million sterling on a no-deal Brexit. I mean, that's a huge investment. And one would wonder, I know the suggestion is he's delivering the mission of the backers, but actually, do they know what Boris's real plan is? I know we all think he couldn't possibly be wanting to risk a no-deal Brexit because of the fallout that's likely to take place.
I think it's something very sinister
around that. But I have to say, the bit I enjoyed this week is the follow-up around Jackie Curry, the Sunday Times exposed last week that she seems to have done rather well out of her relationship with Boris Johnson when he was Mayor of London. And now it seems that she, it's been alleged that she was having an affair with him. And that's in today's paper.
So in case there was any innuendo about whether there was some sort of inappropriate relationship between Boris Johnson and Jennifer Arcuri, at least that now it's no longer innuendo, because at least the Sunday Times says that in fact they were sleeping together at the time, so at least they might straighten it all about. Larry, you wanted to come in on all of that.
Yeah, I wanted to come in, I suppose, just to say to listeners, if you're effing sick of Brexit, you've got a friend in me at this stage.
A friend in all of us.
And Lucinda Creighton, I think, writing today basically saying that, you know, look, to make any firm predictions as to how this is going to work out would be very, very foolish. And that having been said, she goes on to speculate, and I'll speculate on a couple of different things. First, I'm sick of the wrangling and everything else that's going on in Westminster. What I'm very curious about as somebody who lives for electoral politics is going to be when and if there is a general election, how is this going to play out? And are the people going to thank Boris and reward the Conservative Party, or will there be some kind of backlash? Will it be a great election for the Lib Dems? I'll be watching that carefully.
Would you imagine the Tories would get rewarded for hashtag getting Brexit done, but at the same time then bringing about all of the negative immediate consequences that a no-deal Brexit brings, the food shortages, the medicine shortages and whatnot?
That's the great unknown. I mean, I really don't know how that will pan out. I mean, one would have to think that if there are short-term catastrophic consequences, that the electorate would react strongly to that. But I don't know. I mean, I just can't get a good gauge on where the electorate is on all of this. The other thing that I'm watching for is, again, there's this idea, I think, in the UK, and maybe it's subscribed to here, that continually the British government can keep kicking the can down the road. And I'm just wondering the extent to which in Brussels people are dead tired of this and saying either to be vulgar, piss or get off the pot. And also member states in particular in the East who aren't as tied into the UK economy are saying enough is enough, just go get this over with. And the last thing I think in an overarching sense is this demonstrates the need, I think, for the United Kingdom to adopt a written constitution. Yeah. I think so much of what's happened has been going on in a vacuum, and all the uncertainty that's accompanied it. I think at least to some extent that could have been cleared up if they had a written constitution.
Yeah, it's a nice premise. I don't know how easy it would be to try and codify all of the various bits and pieces and arms that they'd need to try to get narrowed down into a single written document, but certainly this week has shown up the difficulties in not having something codified, or that any different law can be interpreted as an amendment to the constitution that's already there. One thought that I have around the way in which Boris Johnson has gone about this, and I agree with Tanya's point that I thought it was breathtaking how, having, you know, he could have gone in very scolded on Wednesday morning and come back to address a parliament that he thought he had shut down, and there was no sense of contrition
Tim Shipman has an interesting line in the Sunday Times today that apparently Boris had to be talked down from denouncing the Supreme Court judges on his way back from the UN in New York because he was furious about it, and I think he wanted to go out and scold them, according to Tim Shipman.
It's fascinating to a point though as well, because I think the one thing which you can argue is very effective about the way in which Boris Johnson has gone about addressing all of this, particularly in the last few days, but which is also worrisome for the long term, is that in this whole battle to try and pitch people versus parliament, to present himself as standing up for the people and the Brexit mandate that they gave versus a parliament that doesn't want it and apparently now a judiciary that doesn't want it, and now he is a hostage in number 10 because he wants the general election to give himself a stronger mandate. It's all well and good to say, you know, Parliament is foiling the will of the people, or that the judiciary are foiling the will of the people right now. But at some point, hashtag Brexit will have been done. And there's still going to have to be a general society afterwards where people are going to need to trust judges to be independent and to reach the right conclusions. And they're going to need to trust the MPs that they deliver to act in the public interest. And they're going to need to trust the government that they elect to act similarly as well. And my concern is that, much and all as effective as it is that Boris is now effectively pitching himself as being the sole defender of the public mandate, that he might be kind of burning the institutions of state forevermore afterwards, or that it will at least be generations before people still have the same faith in an independent judiciary.
I wouldn't take as pessimistic a view as that, but I do think that he is creating a situation where I think you're right, that after Brexit is done, British society isn't going to, you know, isn't going to overnight heal. It's going to take years, and it's going to take possibly a couple of electoral cycles for this to work its way out of the system. And it, of course, depends on what Brexit does to the British economy and what it does to the British people. And I mean, most economic assessments would indicate that it's going to be fairly horrendous, and that Britain is going to become this kind of, I don't know, sort of pariah state that. Is permanently in recession.
He's going to keep riding this wave of this very toxic form of English nationalism as long as he can. And he just has no concern for the big society piece. Remember David Cameron, when he was Prime Minister, it was all going to be about society. I think the Tory party had abandoned
that. That was spin for cutbacks, though, wasn't it? Because basically, I'm going to cut back on library staff, so society is going to have to step in and volunteer to run the
libraries.
They're
going to volunteer and fill the gap. That was his big idea. But there was some sort of attempt to say, look, we do care about society. I think with Boris, that's all gone. And if you look at the whole, everything that they are pitching electorally, you know, investing in policing, investing in schools, it's all really what they've done their polling. They've worked out what the people want, and that's what he's going to stand up for. What was really interesting as well on Saturday, as the stories came out around Jackie Akuri, that he rolled out Carrie Simmons with him to the Tory conference. So, you know, she gives him a bit of legitimacy, you know. But the other thing I thought was interesting was, and this goes back to society, was, you know, you probably saw he issued a threat essentially to the judiciary, saying that I think we're going to have to look at judicial appointments, looking for US style type judicial appointments. And I'm sure that's a warning to them. If you issue another decision against me like that, that's what you're going to have to face into the future.
We can advise him that it does take an awfully long time to overhaul the appointment of judiciary, as well any member of Shannon Aaron could tell us.
But he's not a details man.
In the UK.
No,
though,
we
don't.
Larry, just before we go to a break, you mentioned that your fascination for the electoral side of politics, and there is an interesting consequence to all of this. You mentioned what would happen to the Conservative vote. There's also the question mark about what would happen to the Labour vote, because if the Lib Dems were to poll somewhere close to Labour, you could have a situation where Labour could, according to one analysis today in the Sunday Times, be losing up to 100 seats, which surely then means that Corbyn's goose is cooked as well.
Yeah, it's extraordinary. And I think this goes to the point of the incalculable damage to the body politic in the United Kingdom at the moment. But I mean, Labour is looking, by their projections, looking at losing 100 seats here, which is just extraordinary. Now, a large portion of those, I suspect, will defect to the Liberal Democrats. But one of the other interesting things in here is that 10% of Labour voters intend to defect to the Brexit Party, which is quite extraordinary on the face of it. And again, it's hard to know where they are on the political spectrum. So, look, there's been a big vacuum in all of this, and it's been a failure of leadership, in my view, from the Labour Party. And again, it's suffering the consequences still.
All coming up in the season finale of Britain, which will air at some point on 24-hour rolling news in the next 6 to 8 weeks or so. Still joined by Hugh O'Connell, Tanya Ward and Larry Donnelly. Larry, I know you were, like the rest of us, sometimes you find it difficult to detach from one news cycle and enter another, but the Trump impeachment that has gotten underway this week, or at least the process about setting about it, that the Meta process has gotten underway this week. First of all, what do you see as the prospects for a timetable for all of this? And B, given the fact that this will break down along party lines, where the House will probably vote for it and the Senate will absolutely stop it. Is it not only ultimately going to serve to divide the United States even more, that if you go about trying to impeach a president that you know is a process that's almost doomed to failure from the outset?
Yeah, that's probably true. I'm loath to put an absolute timetable on it, but what I will say is, if I was Nancy Pelosi and she was reluctant to call for impeachment inquiry, if I'm her, I'm getting these committee chairmen and women to work round the clock to get them to marshal the things together, to come up with the articles and get this going, because the longer it goes on, the more people tune out. It goes on a boil. Different things will come up.
It's taken over by the primaries next year, and
this goes away. If I'm her, let's get this done ASAP. Now, in terms of it, as a strategy, her hand was forced. She had no choice, because the ranks of those who wanted impeachment grew so quickly in light of the revelations this past week. So she had to do it. Now, will it divide the United States? It absolutely will. There's no question about it. And could it backfire on the Democrats politically? Yes, it could well, because the American people, I think, don't like impeachment. I don't like it. It's embarrassing. It's a horrible process. 37%, only 37%. 87% of the American people want Trump to be impeached. At least that was the opinion of the poll that was released last week. The majority, vast majority, and including some who are not going to vote for him, still don't want him to be impeached. So how this is going to break is anyone's guess. I mean, I suspect what will happen is he will be impeached, but this is DOA in the Senate because Trump's standing with ordinary Republicans is so high. They need 20 Republicans to defect. I just don't see this happening absent something really extraordinary coming out.
So even if something extraordinary was to be uncovered through the committee hearings that the House Intelligence Committee might now be pursuing, did the Democrats slightly show their hand a little bit, though, by announcing that they were going to get all of this underway before we saw the whistleblower testimony, before we saw the transcript of the phone call with the Ukrainian president, where basically they were only working off secondhand press reports of what the transcript was going to tell them, and they decided that even on that basis was enough to get going, that it does look as if that they're putting party before fact.
Absolutely. I think it was a big mistake to go as fast as they did, but again, I think that Nancy Pelosi's hand was forced. Do not underestimate the enmity for Donald Trump within the Democratic Party, especially on the left of the Democratic Party. Some, and this is one of Trump's effective lines of defense, is, you know, they've been saying since day one, we want him out. Our number one priority isn't the issues. Our number one priority is to get him out of office and make sure he doesn't get a second term. That's an effective line of defense for Donald Trump when he takes that to the American people, because he's saying, look, Democrats don't stand for anything. All they want is to get me out of office. That's a worrying line of attack for the Democrats. So, you know, look, it just one of the things I think that could have been done, and this was posed by a Boston Globe columnist during the week, was knowing that we can't get impeachment, we can't remove the man from office, maybe a censure resolution in the House of Representatives where you would effectively put Republicans on the record as saying, you know, are you going to vote to censure this guy's conduct? Because no matter what you think,
would they do that? Would the Republicans back that anyway?
That would put them in a very awkward position. And again, that's why I think it has some appeal to go down that route rather than impeachment. Because again, I just don't see it succeeding. And I think potentially it could assist the president. And ironically, the very thing that the impeachment, pro-impeachment crowd want, which is not a second term, it would be ironic if they helped to facilitate it by going down this road.
Tanya, I'm just thinking that there's every chance that if Donald Trump were, even if he were to be impeached by the House but survived, that then if he goes to 2020 and he says, listen, even Congress can't get rid of me, you possibly couldn't, that there's very little chance of him surviving an impeachment and then being unseated by a Democratic challenger next year. He was almost home and hosed for another 5 years then, wouldn't he?
That's right. I mean, I think it's pretty extraordinary, to be honest, that the Democrats did push for impeachment proceedings, particularly because they didn't have the numbers to do that in the Senate, but also because, as you say, Bill Clinton got extra support because of the impeachment process. It's an unforced error. They should have stuck with an election strategy. And I really like the idea of the censure, because putting the Republicans on the spot and saying, do you back this behaviour or not? And again, if you look at the whole story, it shifted the story away from what they actually got up to. You were these two good fellas, Trump and Rudy Giuliani, cooked up this scheme, and they set out to try and achieve it. I mean, it's extraordinary stuff what they tried to do. But the story ends up being about impeachment. And I think if you look at the deeper strategy around the Democrats, I mean, they have a problem, I think, with the candidates that they're running at the moment. Elizabeth Warren, we were just talking earlier, looks like she's the one that's going to come up on top, but she's unlikely to unseat Donald Trump. And I think that is very worrying. The only thing that might work to unseat him is if a recession happens and hits. That could hit his electoral chances.
Undermine his whole economic
credence.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And if the Democrats are able to find that one issue that the public want, like they did with the last elections that took place, they focused in on health and they kept the discussion on health. That's how they won. That's what they have to do this time around. So as Larry said, get this impeachment process complete as soon as possible and move on to the next thing.
Hashtag get impeachment done. Hugh, do you agree that Elizabeth Warren would be as weak a candidate against Donald Trump, or do you think she'd have any hope?
We were talking about it off air earlier, and Larry's more of an expert than I, but I think that all of the top tier of candidates in the Democrat, there's no shortage of people running for the Democratic nomination, but the top tier, they all have very glaring weaknesses. I mean, Joe Biden is, I think, weakened by the fact he's been around for a hell of a long time, and he's older than Trump, I think. Obviously, this whole controversy around Ukraine is driven by his own son's involvement in Ukraine and some questions that have arisen out of that. So he's weak. He's the front runner whose lead has been steadily eroded by Elizabeth Warren over the last few weeks. She, in the poll I saw, in a poll I saw last week, had overtaken him. She's now the front runner, but she is a, you know, she's very much to the left. She's talking about a lot of radical ideas. She's talking about taking money off billionaires in the United States, and I dare say they won't be happy about that. So all of the money will be targeted, I think, at her and trying to discredit her. And certainly Trump would relish coming up against her, having come up against another Democratic woman.
The ages
woman,
that you mentioned are
3 years ago
are remarkable. That Joe Biden, Donald Trump is 73. He's the oldest first-term president there's ever been. Joe Biden is 76 at present. He would be, if he were to be elected, he would be 77 at the time of taking the oath. In fact, actually, he would have just turned 78 at the time of taking the oath as a first-term president. Elizabeth Warren is 70 years old, and the person who's instigating all of this, Nancy Pelosi, is 79. You wonder where's the generation of leaders coming behind.
I think what's to blame there, though, is the way the Democrats have stacked up the leadership elections. I mean, you had to have so many donors to get through all the different debates. So that meant some younger talent that could have potentially won an election didn't actually come through. So like someone like Bill Clinton wouldn't have come through with the way the Democrats have stacked it up. So it's only people with national profiles like Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, or people that have a lot of money behind them have been able to get through because they can generate this big public persona.
You're absolutely right. What the Democratic Party has done is fundamentally undemocratic. Because they wanted to have orderly debates, they've shut people off. And when you're a new candidate, when you're trying to get your message out there, if you're denied a podium at a debate, you're finished.
Yeah.
And so there are other candidates who aren't getting heard from, including my own candidate, Tim Ryan, a congressman from Ohio, who I think would defeat Donald Trump and defeat him handily, aren't getting a place. Instead, we have the older generation, and as you have said, serious, serious drawbacks as political candidates. Yeah. Sanders, Biden, and Warren all have serious flaws as political candidates.
By the way, 78 years old, and he would also be 79 if he were to be inaugurated. Tim Ryan, a mere 46, a spring chicken. But of course, that means that he's got 30 years to finally get his way to the top table, doesn't he? We're going to have to leave it at that. My thanks to all of you for coming in this morning. Really appreciated the chat. Tanya Ward is CEO of the Children's Rights Alliance. Larry Donnelly is a Boston attorney and a law lecturer at NUI Galway. And Hugh O'Connell is political correspondent at Independent Newspapers. Thank you all.